Welcome to the Frontiers Podcast, a production of the Heartland Institute for Translational Research. For more information on this program, visit frontiersresearch.org. Frontiersresearch.org. In this edition of the Frontiers Podcast, we visit with Dr. Atul Butte of the Stanford University School of Medicine. Dr. Butte delivered a presentation entitled Transforming 300 Billion Points of Data into Diagnostics, Therapeutics, and New Insights into Disease during a symposium in Kansas City on May 31st, 2012. I'll have to admit, Dr. Butte, I was a little bit uncomfortable with thoughts of 1984 and George Orwell and all these different things that we have on ourselves, the data, the zettabytes that you're talking about. Do you ever run into people that are a little bit concerned that we have so much of this that's available by a few clicks to a website?
Yeah, so I think there are definitely people who are concerned about not the measurement aspect of it, but what adverse things could be done with those measurements that may impact them. And I think one thing it's important to note is, though I talked about a lot of different types of measurements, like DNA, like the RNA from cells, the blood pathology, things like that, in most cases in academia, we use it in a de-identified manner. So what that means is that we might have access to those samples and can run measurements on it, testing hypotheses, but we don't know who those original individuals are or were. And so I think that's the level of safety that the public should expect from biomedical science today. Now, in most institutions, if not all, that do federally funded research have to have an institutional review board or an IRB. So obviously other scientists serve on those boards as well as administrators, but nearly all of them have lay public as well serving on there to make sure that the public interest is served. So it is not easy to get identifiable samples and data. If one wants or somehow needs that, one has to go in front of an IRB and explain exactly why. And typically, in my experience, their default answer is no, that cannot be obtained. So everything I talked about today was really done with de-identified samples. There's no need for me to know the name or the address or any of that for the individuals for whom those samples were obtained from.
Still, I caught a sense of surprise in this group that this is so readily available, almost like buying a book on Amazon. Do you find that people are surprised by that?
Absolutely. They're surprised because I think maybe people thought this was going to be science fiction someday, that we could really purchase samples for research. I know Michael Crichton, actually, who's written many books, Jurassic Park and others, had written a book several years ago called Next, where people, it was almost facetiously science fiction-y, that people would buy cancer cell lines and buy animal models with a credit card. And all of a sudden, we have this mode today. Now, to most scientists, this sounds amazing, and they are very skeptical right off the bat. There is this tendency in science that what one does in their own lab is, of course, better than what everyone else can do in their lab. And so that's the not invented here type of syndrome, and people do have to get around that. I think a lot of scientists have been doing that in terms of outsourcing things like sequencing and things like that, but they will have to eventually get faith that the measurements and the experiments that are hired or contracted will have high quality and that the data is handled in a sensitive kind of way.
So that was one of your three really take-home points today, that there is a lot of data that's there, and we have to figure out how to use that data.
Yeah, there is a lot of data. And even if we do nothing, the data continues to increase. The journals require it. The funding agencies require it. They require sharing now because there is this general sense that it is good for people to share data. Science is supposed to be a reproducible field and a transparent field. When people are hiding data, it's not seen in a positive light anymore. In fact, just even journal articles themselves, there's increasing calls for that to be made publicly available. For example, research institutions in the UK last month at University of California, San Francisco, UCSF, earlier this week, faculty have voted that their papers need to be publicly available on day one. Of course, faculty at Harvard did this a year or two ago. So there's enough data. There's plenty of data. There's still always going to be more data. The new magic is figuring out what do we want to ask of that data. The code, the software, the tools, the statistics, all of that is doable. I'm not even going to say it's the hard part. I'm not even going to say it's the hard part to go buy big computers. We can commission those through Amazon cloud services and things like that. I could get, I could get, if I needed one computer that had a terabyte of RAM, I could create a virtual one on Amazon today with my credit card, use it for my purpose, and then all of a sudden it disappears into the ether again. That's not the hard part. The hard part is really figuring out what do we want to ask to take the unmet medical need that we'll see in a grand rounds or surgical grand rounds, that we don't have good therapies for this, and translate that into the recognition that we already have data there that we could use to answer those questions.
You work with Frontiers locally on an advisory capacity, external advisory board. What have you found from this group here, this Frontiers group, here in Kansas City, Missouri, and on the Kansas side as well?
I think it's still early days. It's not even been a year since the grant has been funded. So I'm really here to review the past year to see where have things gone from the day one to day 365 today. I have a lot of hopes. I think the institutions here, and there are numerous institutions, not just the one, there are numerous institutions involved here, have and bring a lot of capacity. I think the most important is the human element, that there is a lot of human capital here that's looking to start new ventures, both academic and industrial. I think that's really unparalleled. But the corporate experience here, the old Marion pharmaceutical legacy, all that's unparalleled. So we have high hopes for, I have high hopes for what I'm going to be seeing here. Hope that we can provide some advice to make sure that things go in the right direction.
What have you found to be a common denominator of success amongst the various groups that you work with?
The CTSA programs, and now 60 of them have been funded, and I can't say that there's a common theme there. So some institutions were way ahead in some ways doing translational research than others. And so it's not clear what success means here, right? So to some, success means getting this grant renewed in 5 years. Yes, that's helpful, of course. To some,
pretty basic.
To some, success means enabling more grants to be written. That could be interesting. That could drive more science to be done at the university. To some, science means, or success here means, more people enrolled in trials or more trials being run at that institution. That's probably a good thing that helps patients with rare diseases, diseases where we're still trying to figure out new therapies. But I think the jury's still out. What exactly success means here? To me, it means really getting more things, whether it's devices, drugs, diagnostics, into the hands of patients and physicians. I think even if we are comfortable in academia thinking, they're not going to require that of us for decades to come, I think the public is going to require this sooner than we think from these types of grants.
I get a sense from this that this is calling upon these different organizations and institutions who have been competitive in the past to be much more collaborative than they've ever thought of being.
I think in theory, the CTSAs are supposed to work with each other and to sit together and figure out national standards. One could even imagine, I think one imagined 5 years ago, someday pushing a button to say we have a new drug, let's go find every single patient in the country with this disease and see if their disease benefits from this drug. Nationwide instant virtual clinical trials. I'm not sure how long it will take to get there. Now, there is a lot to be said about cooperation between these centers, but again, some are more ahead than others. And so in that way, I'm not sure if we all started the race at the same place, in other words. But we've also seen that it is not trivial to get these renewed either. That many places that really had their act together in terms of clinical and translational research still have struggled to get another 5 years out of this program. And I think what it means is that this is going to be a program. CTSAs themselves seem to be a program of change. That by no means is this going to be just a static type of architecture for a funding mechanism.
Would it be fair to say that there's a push that everyone's feeling with, say, for example, and something that we bring up a lot is the baby boomer generation and the demands, the much higher demands for treatments that will address chronic disease and Alzheimer's. Do you sense any kind of a push like that?
I think the CTSAs have been relatively disease agnostic. If there's any one population that seems to be called out, it is pediatrics, of all things. I'm a pediatrician, so I do like that. But really, because clinical translational research has been the hardest to really affect in the United States in kids. Pharmaceutical companies sometimes do it if it's in their interest. But so if anything, there's been a call out there. I think there are a number of challenges out there. We have the chronic disease challenge. We have the rare disease challenge, where there's no pharmaceutical interest often in developing drugs for those rare diseases, rare but collectively affecting a lot of people altogether. I think there are a lot of special populations and special disorders that could use this help. So I think they've stayed relatively agnostic. But I'm not sure what's in store for the next 5 to 10 years of this program. There are rumors that things could be more molecular moving forward, that one could set metrics for how many drugs and diagnostics actually made it through a pipeline rather than how many people hit the website that helps enable others to do this. And that might sound like a subtlety, but it also means a little bit more of a hands-on process, not necessarily always staying in a mode of building it and waiting for people to come.
Dr. Atul Butte is Division Chief and Associate Professor of Systems Medicine, Department of Pediatrics at Stanford University. He also serves on the External Advisory Board for Frontiers, the Heartland Institute for Clinical and Translational Research. For more information about Frontiers, visit frontiersresearch.org. Frontiersresearch.org. I'm Laura LeBou. Thanks for listening to the Frontiers Podcast.